Hey, it's Coin Talk, the show about Bitcoin crashes, mostly. I'm Aaron Lammer. My co-host is Jay Kang. We'll be on shortly. We talked in this episode about lessons from the crash. We talked about Augur finally launching its first prediction market. We talked about Binance, whether it was hacked, and what the lack of transparency from exchanges really means. And finally, we talked about the hearings in the Senate with the CFTC and the SEC, and the lionization of the CFTC chairman, Christopher Giancarlo, in the crypto community. Some great stuff. You don't want to miss it. We are brought to you in partnership with Medium. You can find every episode of the show at medium.com/cointalk. You can also find it in whatever podcast app you want to, but what you can't find in any podcast you want to are the transcripts of this show, which are all up on Medium in case you would like to read rather than listen to it. Medium has a really great membership program. I think it's $5 a month, $50 a year. It gets you all kinds of exclusive stuff, and you're not limited to a certain number of our transcripts, blah, blah, blah. It's totally worth it. I use it all the time. A lot of the crypto reading I do for this show is on Medium. So thanks to them for helping support this show. And here is the show.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Thursday, February 8th at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $8,348.
Hey, welcome to Coin Talk. I'm Aaron Lammer, here with Jay Kang. Jay Kang, on the road.
Yeah, once again.
You are a traveling man. I was leaving on a jet plane.
Last few weeks have been a little bit rough, but, you know, the hotel is not so bad this time.
Oh, hey.
So that's where I'm recording right now.
That's a beautiful thing. So we actually, this is the second time we recorded this week, but the last time was a guest appearance on LedgerCast, Ledger Status's podcast. So I haven't talked to you since then. When we take that, we were at the absolute rock bottom, and I mean emotionally rock bottom, of the crash. 3 days have passed. It's not like we're up that much since then, but I feel up.
Yeah, well, I do too, which is strange because I remember panic selling at 8,500 and then,
hey, cheers to your panic sell. Cheers to your panic sell.
This was like 4 days ago or whenever it was at 8,500. And then, it went up to like 8,900 and then I FOMO'd back in immediately. And then I was like, oh, good job. Good job. Good job. You know, at least we're not, when it goes back to 14,000, this will all be okay. And then of course it crashed further. So, you know, the psychology of it is pretty interesting because it's not like you or I, like, you know, really bought the bottom aggressively, like, you know, cause we're not, I guess we're not so brave. And so we're actually just still down the same amount we were 4 days ago when we were really depressed, but we feel much better about it.
Yeah, I think that for me, like, the difference between like a few days of stability at the bottom versus like the moment we hit the bottom couldn't be more different. In some ways, like, and we've talked about this, I feel like now that the market has corrected, even though I'm just utterly wrecked, as someone who is holding about a 50% alts during that whole thing, I feel like a little bit like more solid. Like I feel like the foundation of the house is a little bit better built now. Am I crazy?
Well, I mean, if you look at any sort of market cycle, right, then I think, look, this is not something I'm an expert on, but I've seen some tweets. It's very unhealthy to just blow the top off, and this sort of correction was probably necessary. We can say that in hindsight, but yeah. You know, the speed with which there is adoption, the flourishing of shit coins everywhere, and the sort of completely unregulated mess that was happening with Bitfinex and Tether. We don't know how much impact it had, but it's, you know, I don't think that anyone at this point is completely convinced that, even if you don't think it was important or had any effect, like, I don't think that you feel good about what was happening and think it was all in the up and up. All that was bound to come back down. I was just shocked at how far down it came and the sort of strength of the correction, but I guess, like, in retrospect, it just kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I think I always thought, and I believe the sort of prevailing belief is, as it hovered above 10,000 there, when it was in that 10,000 to 12,000 range, that institutional buyers were sort of grabbing the dips and stopping it from dropping below 10,000. And I had believed that there was enough institutional interest and sort of whale interest that no one was going to let it go anywhere near 6,000, that there was just too many people who were going to shark it up. But one of the things I'm slowly learning about Bitcoin is Bitcoin feels huge when you're within it. But within the financial system as a whole, it's not like it hasn't like taken over the entire thing. So there aren't hundreds of these whales and institutional investors out there. Once a few people have put in a few big buys, you can tap out the like support fairly quickly. Am I just reading too much into the tea leaves?
I mean, I think one of the fun things about Bitcoin is that like how little we know. So we don't know. Like, I mean, generally you should be able to see market manipulation, especially on a distributed ledger that's available to everybody. And you should be able to time it with futures markets open and closing and volume and make a decent case. Maybe it's not a case that's perfectly causative, but you could at least show compelling correlation. And the fact that nobody can do that either means that the people who are sort of thinking about crypto are all kind of bad, you know, or new at this, or it just means that, you know, everything is completely opaque and we have no idea. We can just kind of say, ah, it's Asia, you know, and throw up our hands. That's where I'm at.
I find one of the more fascinating themes in our chat is that the whole system feels completely opaque, yet the system is set up in a way that it couldn't be more transparent. Literally, anyone can go look at the entire ledger. If I was pitching the blockchain to someone and it didn't yet exist, I would say, we're going to solve all of these problems of opaqueness and we're going to root out all kinds of scamminess because everyone will be able to see. Everyone's going to play with their hands up. So if someone puts, you know, a fifth ace into the deck, we are all going to know about it. In reality, it's been quite the opposite. It reminds me of like the era of big data on the web, where there's just like such a huge amount flowing through the bottleneck that even though everyone can see it, no one can make any sense out of it. Like, we should be able to solve this Tether thing. Like, we should be able to figure out what's going on. Yet all of these smart people are looking into it and it's crashed the market, and yet we still don't really know what's going on.
Okay, so my what I wanted to talk to you about was, if I were to describe this crash and I said, what was the number one cause of it? I think I probably would have ranked Tether. I think the Tether issues around Tether were the biggest single driver, at least among like individual sentiment along this stuff. And the crazy part to me is that, you know, I logged on to Bittrex yesterday morning after my traditional morning period, I logged on to Bittrex. I was like, oh shit, all these US dollar Tether markets are still there. Like, we scared the shit out of ourselves with Tether, but we didn't actually root Tether out of the system. What does it mean that we've had a crash, but even if we start going back up now, we're always going to have Tether in the rear view mirror?
Well, they're not printing as many in the same sort of suspicious timing, I think, that alerted.
Couldn't
people.
They just be lying low right now? I feel like that was the assumption.
We do know that the company was subpoenaed,
yes,
right?
On December 6th was the date of the subpoena.
And so we do know some things. I do think that, I mean, I think it would be very hard for Bittrex to just kind of like cancel the Tether markets immediately after.
Yeah.
Without any sort of actually hard evidence. And I do think a study came out recently, maybe yesterday, that said that there was very little correlation and that, you know, it echoed a lot of what people are saying, which is that, hey, this stuff is shady and yes, we should look into it. But this sort of narrative that this is like the user Willy that was on Mt. Gox that was like driving up prices by himself, that maybe this is a bit of an overreach. Yeah. I'm still in that space. I would agree with you that in terms of the way in which the media pushed the November to December retail user, like those people, the media then turned around and pushed this Tether story, and I think it scared a lot of these people away. Especially with the price crashing anyway for reasons that had to do with Asian markets and stuff like that. I think it gave a lot of people a very convenient excuse to exit. And so, I think that the Tether, if we had to rank them,
I think I would put Tether number one, but it wouldn't be like kind of like the way that you would rank NBA teams where the Warriors are like clearly number one and then everybody.
Thank you. I appreciate that analogy.
that everyone else is kind of like fighting for a number two that doesn't really matter.
Yes.
Like I think that, you know, that Tether might be number one and then sort of, yeah. you know, like Asian regulatory problems number two. And then three is just this sort of like life cycle of when, of sort of almost a gambler's life cycle of when you get super into something and you buy in at 17,000 and you're hoping, you're expecting it to go to 34,000 immediately. yeah. And that it doesn't. And so you're just like, well, I'm just going to cut my losses and I'm going to just go back to my life and I'm never going to pay attention to cryptocurrency again because, you know, it's a bunch of like libertarian dudes who are screaming at me all the time. I think there's some of that as well, where it's just sort of like market fatigue, like how many days in a row or how many weeks in a row could Coinbase have reasonably expected to be signing up hundreds of thousands of people a day? Like at some point, like, you know, like you just run out of people who are interested in that space.
A lot of crypto news is cyclical. You think, oh, the China ban, like a crash, but actually there's been a China ban crash like every 6 months for a period yeah. of years.
How many China ban crashes have we been through?
I'm guessing we're going to hear from Tether again. I think that like this Tether issue has not been resolved. And I agree with you. There's no easy way to just root Tether out of the system in a day. But it's disturbing to me that we clearly identified a problem. The media identified a problem. Investors identified a problem. And we didn't correct course at all. We didn't like kick Tether out of the club. So I think that's something I'll be looking at going forward.
I mean, is the volume of trading with Tethers going down at all?
I haven't really seen any indications. The Tether stands were like partying on it, saying like, "You look, Tether's trading at $1.03. Fuck yeah."
I did see that.
So
it was the only green coin for a while.
So we didn't hurt Tether. I mean, like when I traced these narratives, I was thinking about like the guy, there was that New York Times story about Puertopia, yeah. Nelly Bowles story. And Brock Pierce, who's one of the founders of Tether, is down there trying to like form a like crypto utopia while like fear of Tether is bringing down the market. There's no consequence for any of these. Whoa. We're experimenting with a shot clock here at CoinTalk.
Well, I mean, the exchanges still, I think, are the most vulnerable way for, I mean, we've said this 1,000 times,
yes.
but I think the opacity of the market and of Bitcoin, honestly, is because of the opacity of the exchanges. So
yep.
let's talk about one of those exchanges. You want to, Aaron?
Yeah, I'd love to. I'm assuming that you want to talk about Binance.
Yeah, so Binance it was just featured, I think, in Forbes where the head of it, who goes by CZ, who the Binance is in Hong Kong and I think also in Tokyo, that he came out and, you know, they're sort of featuring him as one of these.
I think it was the list of the
new hot things.
Richest people in crypto. I believe we're all.
Yeah, so
all
it was
men,
like,
I
you
think.
Know, like the Vanity Fair cover where they say like the new Hollywood, they do it every year.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. Annie Leibovitz photographs it. This is sort of the crypto version of it. So I think almost hours after that thing was floating around online and being distributed.
Yeah. It's kind of amazing also because there's a guy in the set who looks like a poor man's Johnny Depp. Like yeah. Brock Pierce looks like a crypto millionaire impersonating a Hollywood star.
Yeah, well, avoid the Forbes crypto list curse here, I guess. So yeah. Binance shut down and you couldn't buy or sell. You couldn't really access your wallets. And most importantly, and I think most frighteningly for everybody, you couldn't withdraw any of your funds. And so CZ came out on Twitter and did a lot of like, this is not a hack. This is not a hack. This is not a hack. This is a data sync problem. This is a data sync problem. Nonetheless, it was a big enough problem, I think, given the sort of atmosphere around the crash and sort of the FUDing that's going around that the Financial Times wrote about it. And they didn't seem to exactly know what had happened. They were just sort of writing a news story about it, as one does. And I wanted to point out what CZ's response to the tweet of the article was, because I think it's indicative of something, but I also just find it funny. They write a tweet, they say, cryptocurrency exchange Binance suspends trading and withdrawals. And CZ's response is, thanks for the coverage and advertising. We still have lots of room to improve. We are hiring. which is the most crypto response
troll
ever,
on.
Which is just like,
troll on.
Dude, like your exchange just shut down and all your customers can't withdraw their money.
Yeah.
Like, how about you not troll the Financial Times right now?
Well, also, the fact that he's trolling the Financial Times, like, okay, do you think someone running an exchange would be honest if they did get hacked? Like, some of them, eventually they would be, but I feel like most people would be like, is there a way that we can hide this hack by moving assets? Which is my understanding of basically what happened at Mt. Gox was that they were moving around the deck chairs of the Titanic for a while, seeing if they basically not admit what happened. And the fact that there's this kind of flippant tone around it, just like, I'm like, that guy would definitely not care about lying to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, we do not know CZ, if you'd like to come on the podcast.
I'd love to have him on the podcast. On. I mean, I like his swaggering style. What can I say?
Empirically, like what you were talking about is that after Mt. Gox, I think this is in the Nathaniel Popper book, Mark Karpolis, the guy who was running it, started going around to other exchanges in Asia and being like, dude, like, what if we joined forces and you kind of like fronted me for a while? And eventually everyone was just kind of horrified and like, dude, you have to tell somebody.
What if we merged and all my records were lost in a fire during the merger? Would that be something you were interested in?
Yeah, exactly. It's like if someone robbed Bank of America and Bank of America went to Chase and was like, all right, bro, how about we merge right now and you float me a little bit of money so that like if people want to take $80 out of fast cash at the ATM that, you know, they're not going to get a zero notice for a bit. And then in the meantime, like, we can just print money to fill it back up. I mean, it made absolutely no sense. So
it's kind of the same problem we're dealing with Tether right now, which is just that there's no transparency that exchanges / companies like Tether are actually have all the stuff that has been custodially left with them. And the fact that we don't know, there's really no way to know, because the first, 50% of people who withdraw are going to get their money anyway, even if you've lost half the money.
Yeah. Aaron, are you a Binance customer?
I'm not a Binance customer. No. I think there's different. We talk about different generations in crypto. I feel like Binance was a little bit before our time.
No. I mean, I think it was a little after
our time. OK, yeah.
Well, I mean, I do have a Binance.
Oh, you do have
account.
A Binance account.
Yeah. And for a while, I had my rather heavy 0x bag on it.
Okay.
Because the only reason I signed up was because I wanted to buy 0x. And you know what? This is the first time I think I'm going to do this on the podcast, but I think I made a good decision.
Wow.
Because at some point...
Okay, time to shut down the show.
I pulled everything off of Binance, not for any reason, just because... it was almost like a feng shui type of thing where I was sick of having to like mentally add up all the money I had across all these accounts. So I sold all my 0x into Bitcoin and then pulled it back into a hardware wallet.
Yeah.
So that when I loaded it up, I didn't have to like do mental math because I'm that dumb and lazy.
Yeah, I think this is something we talked about when we were on the Ledger cast. One thing I'm considering doing is limiting myself. This is what I call the Blockfolio front page rule. So you can see seven things without scrolling on the front page of your Blockfolio. I'm strongly considering limiting myself to seven coins at a time. There's a few reasons for that. One is just something Ledger said, which I think is true, which is just hard to keep track. It's hard to really stay on top of everything if you've got all your investments spread over so many coins. But I also think you're highlighting a secondary issue, which is if you've got a gazillion coins, you've probably got them on a gazillion exchanges. And we're seeing pretty clearly that not every exchange is going to get hacked, but some of them are going to have some kind of problem. And it just feels to me like the more exchanges you're spread out over, the more exposed you are to that.
Okay, I want to talk about Augur, which is a... prediction market, and it's one of the oldest ICOs. It's one of the oldest projects. They are going
first
to,
altcoin I ever bought.
They're going to launch a product finally after all these years, and they're going to launch a prediction market that involves one question, which is, will Augur be hacked? Now, this harkens back to sort of the history of prediction markets.
Wait. That they're posing that question?
Yeah, that's their, well, that's the only question that you can bet on Augur during this sort of soft launch. This harkens back to the actual history of prediction markets, where the first question ever posed by a prediction market was, where will be the next place that there will be a terrorist attack? And that some people in the DOD, working with DARPA, I believe,
yep,
decided to do this because they felt like if you could introduce financial incentive, that there might be someone somewhere in the world who actually would have knowledge of this and would try and profit, and that they would put in a bunch of money on one of the questions.
Yep.
And so I think that is a question that is a very strange, obviously that eventually became banned because it's an incredibly ghoulish way.
Yeah.
And now we have a robust prediction market economy that involves everything like, when will Sean Spicer be fired, or like, when will like Scaramucci get fired? All that sort of stuff is out there. Augur is a prediction market in that way, but it is interesting to me in that they're sort of starting with the same idea that prediction markets started before. I mean, I've heard, how do you feel about this? Are you going to bet on this?
Well, one thing I've always wondered with these prediction markets is like how big a hack, how do they define what a hack would consist of?
I mean, like any sort of prop bet, they would have to figure out what that means. Like, yeah. So for example, like you can bet on Bovada right now if Danica Patrick and Aaron Rodgers, are their relationship is going to last till the end of this year. But the way in which you have to confirm that is that TMZ has to report, has to confirm it.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I think that they would have to build something like that in there. And that actually is one of the problems with prediction markets. It's just like there's so many different ways.
Right.
You kind of need a central authority to actually adjudicate some of this.
Well,
stuff.
It's interesting because usually you're doing it in a real world thing that the people who are making the market have no control over. But in this case, the people making the market are the same people who would be hacked. So they could like hide some kind of a secret formula and say, you know, this will be confirmed when this this code is hacked, basically.
Or they could just hide the hack.
Let me just rewind slightly and say, I don't quite understand Augur. So is the idea of Augur that anyone's going to be able to make a prediction market of any question, and then people will be able to bet on it on the Augur platform? It's like a roll your own predictions, or are they going to supply the predictions?
I think that it is a fully decentralized prediction market in which people can create their own prediction markets. And so I think it's closer to something like, you know, if you are living in my neighborhood, for example, and you want to make a prediction market on the city council election,
right,
you can't find that on Predict It. You can find the New York mayoral election, but you can't find these hyper-local things. And so I think the idea is that people can sort of set their own odds, and that you have a completely free, non-centralized thing. Because right now, if you go on Predict It, all the adjudication is done through Predict It. And the bigger problem is that, like, you have a massive fee structure that is built in to predict it.
Damn those fees!
Well, I mean, it's crazy. If they have a 4 to 5% withdrawal fee.
Yeah.
So, like, any amount of money that you make, any volume of money that you make, you have a percentage that's chopped off of it. And I think that that's been very frustrating to people. And I think the idea of Augur is that if you introduce it decentralized and people can make their own rules, and you can create whatever type of prediction market you want.
Yeah. Do you think people will use it to create financial products within crypto? Like, I'm thinking about, like, me and you had a bet, crypto up or down in January, I believe, was our bet.
Yeah, I won that one.
You won that one by, like, if we were weighting it, you won it very handily.
But you won the other one, which was, will Ripple be worth more than a dollar at the end of January?
Oh, yeah.
You crushed that one.
Sorry, Ripple holder. Sorry.
Like, and our settlement was one Ripple. So
you owe me a Ripple?
No, we both owe each other a Ripple.
Okay. We'll exchange that off air. But my question is, could have we set up that bet on Augur?
I don't think you can. I don't think that we could upload Ripple and have that be settled. I think everything is on the Ethereum network, which is its own problem with traffic and everything like that. So I think everything would be settled through.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean settled actually with Ripple, but I just mean, like, could we make bets on Augur that are, like, in some ways, like futures?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So in some ways, Augur can be used to make bets within the crypto market. Like, instead of like actually buying a coin, me and you could like bet against each other on the future of that coin.
Yeah, yeah.
It opens up whole new avenues of fraud and scamminess in trying to manipulate auger bets. If any of these auger bets get enough, and this first one's a great example, like how much money is going to be sitting out there to hack auger? You know, what's the pool of that? If I see someone making a huge bet they're going to hack auger, I wouldn't want to take the opposite out of that bet because they probably already know how to hack auger.
Yeah, they're probably about to hack auger. So I think that it is a fascinating project, and it's one that's going to have large ramifications for all betting markets, honestly, because if it does work without without like a fully centralized adjudicating authority, then it's going to be totally fascinating. And I think most people who are involved in gambling would say that that's impossible, but who knows?
All right. Let's, you wanted to talk a little bit about the Senate hearings that happened. Let's talk about like actual news, like that, you know, normal people.
They were scintillated. I have to admit, I didn't watch them at first. I was like, I'll just like read the tweets. But then I did get around to watching them. And, they've kind of made a star of, I believe he's the Honorable J. Christopher Giancarlo, chairman of the CFTC, and already, I would say, one of the top 10 most beloved figures in crypto now.
I think he's number one.
I mean,
you know, I think he's like the Bruno Mars of crypto.
I like the guy. I like that. He's got that.
Everybody loves him.
He's got that kind of handsome bald man thing going on too, which I'm always like, who's the guy who's on Top Chef?
Colicchio. Tom Colicchio.
Yeah, I feel like him and Colicchio could be like long lost brothers. He's got kind of like a swagger to him. And I also kind of like the way that he wasn't all business. He was like willing to bring up like when he was talking about, I love the part. Let's play the clip when he's talking about, I think it's like his niece buying Bitcoin. Okay, let's play that.
And in fact, what we hear a lot of is people buying and holding. If you go onto the Twitter universe, you'll see a phrase HODL, which means hold on for dear life. And the thinking is that they buy it and hold it. In fact, I mentioned in my opening remarks, my 30-year-old niece, who bought Bitcoin years ago, and she's an HODL. She says, I'm going to own it. I don't know what's going to come of it, but I want to hang on to it. And she's not a fraudster or a manipulator. She's just a kid and believes in it. And, you know, I was fascinated talking to her. And I think she represents a lot of folks that think there's something in this. I want to hold on to it. And so in that regard, it's a, from our point of view, it's a commodity. And if there's a derivative on that, we regulate it. The problem is, in the cash market, we don't have regulatory authority, means we can't set the standards. But what we will do, and we are doing, is looking for fraud and manipulation. And we intend to be very aggressive, if nothing else, so that people like my niece can have some security that there's not fraudsters and manipulators out there. And there are far too many of them.
Okay, so this is something that comes up a lot. Like, I think when Jamie Dimon was talking about Bitcoin, he also brought up his daughter buying Bitcoin. But Giancarlo is kind of going the opposite direction here, where he's like saying, look, you could tell me there are millions of scammers out there. You can't indict the entire system because of these scammers. Because, like, I know this person. This is my family member, and I understand their motivations and their intentions, and their intentions are pure.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I think that's a powerful thing. I mean, you know, I mean, that's why, you know, every politician from Hillary Clinton all the way back to, I don't know, Abraham Lincoln will sprinkle in some personal anecdotes. And I just thought it was very effective. He bridged the gap in a lot of ways between, you know, people who look at Bitcoin and just see a morass of angry libertarians with anime avatars shitposting all day. And, you know, like a lot of the people who did get in the past year, who might have some philosophical reason for it and who have benefited from it, maybe not financially right now.
Yeah.
But they benefited from the same way that, you know, you and I talk about all the time about, which is that before this, like, you and I were financial illiterates, you know?
Yeah.
I had a stock portfolio and a retirement fund, but I did never looked at it. If you told me the market was doing something, I'd be like, I don't care.
you know, and basic and even just sort of psychological, philosophical ideas about money I hadn't really thought about. And I think that what he did bring forward in this talk was that, look, this is actually something that is not just a bunch of scammers trying to get rich. Like, some people really do believe in this, and those people happen to be young. A lot of them are bright, and some of them are people that you probably know. And I think that was a very powerful message.
I totally agree. I thought it was me and you, I think, are like outcasts, black sheep in crypto, because we believe in the idea of regulations. Like, we are not vehemently against regulations. That we can be, we can have an odd standpoint there. I think a lot of people were like, hey, if you believe in regulations, get the fuck out. Insider trading should be legal. Roger Ver. But what I think the path that Giancarlo is charting here is really interesting, because he's obviously someone who believes in regulation himself. He is the chairman of a regulatory association. But what he's saying is, people have the right to invest in the things they believe in. Like, if you believe in Bitcoin, the CFTC should not say you cannot invest in that. You cannot put your money where your mouth is. We'll regulate it, and we have an interest in regulation and rooting out the worst actors in the system. But that does not involve us infringing on the rights of someone who actually believes in this stuff. And so that feels to me, in the long term, like, we're going to figure out how to make this work. We are not, like, you don't give that speech if you're even considering a ban.
Yeah. And I think that that him going in front of the Senate and saying all of this, where a lot of the senators clearly did not know what cryptocurrency was or Bitcoin was. And they had just sort of, I'm sure, read a brief or heard about its crashes. I think that by directly comparing it to the early internet, which is a comparison that happens all of the time.
Very much like the way that Jameson Lopp talked about it when we interviewed him on the show.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yes.
It was a clear and simple way to describe things. And look, you and I talk about this all the time, and I think it's because of our place in media. It's about, like, the messaging of the crypto community and how it can't, like, while I think that this thing would not exist without cypherpunks, without libertarians, it is their vision primarily. I think that mainstream adoption is going to take some sort of adjustment to the messaging so that you can get across this idea that this is a revolutionary technology. It is philosophically interesting to anybody who is frustrated at all with what's happening in the global economy, or even, you know, within sort of the corporatization of this country. If you have problems with that, then you don't have to like Bitcoin, but you should at least think about it, you know? And that's, I think that was essentially his message. I think it was one that's necessary.
Yeah, I was impressed also that he noted, like, when we were talking about Korea, one of the things I brought up with Nathan Park, who is our guest on this show, was Korea is already so crypto crazy. At a certain point politically in Korea, does it make sense to just say, instead of fighting crypto, let's become the crypto country. Let's bet on crypto. Let's push our national interest with it. And if crypto goes crazy worldwide, well, this is a great moment for Korea. And I think that part of what I read into some of the statements that Giancarlo made before the Senate was, look at all the bounty that the internet has brought America. And how important was it to the American economy and the growth of the tech economy that the internet not only happened, but it happened in America. It came out of American government institutions. And we wouldn't have wanted to miss out on that. And I think that, like, what I ultimately took from what he said was, crypto is going to happen, and we should, like, take advantage of it as Americans. Like, America should be part of the crypto story. We should be a leader in crypto, and we should regulate it and become, like, a model for how to deal with this, rather than fighting against it, because if we fight against it, we're probably missing an opportunity of the internet scale. That's my extremely hyperbolic, optimistic read. I don't know if that was all quite in there.
Yeah. All right. What's the second clip you liked?
Is Bitcoin, or are these, as currently being traded, are they a commodity? Or are they a security, or are they both? What's so challenging about Bitcoin is it has characteristics of multiple different things. One of the phrases that's often used is that Bitcoin is a medium of exchange, a store of value, or a means of account. Well, those three things have different connotations to them. If it's a medium of exchange, then it's like a currency-like instrument. And yet, as we've seen, a number of means of exchanges have been closed to Bitcoin. There was recently a Bitcoin conference that stopped accepting Bitcoin for registrants because they couldn't process the payments. So, but yet it's still spoken of as perhaps a means of account. And in that case, it has implications from the Fed and currency. From our point of view, when it's used as a store of value, then it's very much like an asset, like a commodity.
This is sort of the central debate about like what confuses people about Bitcoin. Is it cash? Is it a store of value? And I mean, just to praise Giancarlo a bit more, I'm impressed that this is like, you know, sometimes do you read Supreme Court opinions ever?
Yeah, I mean, I know.
I know you're an argumentative person, so I assume that you probably have read Supreme Court opinions. There are certain people who write Supreme Court opinions like they're high school debaters, and they're just like, "I'm going hard on this side," you know. And then there are some Supreme Court justices whose opinions I enjoy more, where it feels like they're like working through the logic themselves and are in like a genuine exploration of the ideas. And I feel like in this hearing, Giancarlo is like, look, it's not exactly one or the other. Like, all of these things are being developed simultaneously. And when you're like, is it a security or is it a commodity or is it a store of value? You're asking a question about a moving narrative that actually hasn't been decided. It has elements of multiple things. So I just thought it was cool that like it seemed like he like kind of took it on like a stoned college student researching Bitcoin on the internet and kind of like explored all the angles.
Yeah. I think that it was very much like I think that's a perfect way to put it. I mean, it did sound like he had like arrived at some clarity.
Yeah.
You know, perhaps chemically altered clarity. He's like, all right, let me break it down for you.
Yeah.
It's neither. What if it was neither?
I love it when you see this video. It also is kind of a quality of that Lloyd Blankfein video we played when he was talking, where like these guys who have spent their lives in finance and economics kind of take crypto seriously for the first time. And they're like, yeah, I looked into this and it's pretty cool. There's some pretty crazy ideas out there. Like, it's just exciting to me that like people who could be skeptics, when they sort of like look into it, whether they're like for it or against it, they're at least like, it was pretty fascinating.
I mean, and I do think that it is overall, look, we are in a bad time for price, right? The market is not good. But I do think that it made me much more, and this is something I think I was texting you, which is it makes me more bullish on crypto in general, that this is happening even when the market is down, because it makes me think, it like, you know, for example, I actually think that the news out of Korea was essentially pretty good, which was that, you know, they too want to compete to be the Silicon Valley of crypto. United States, it seems like, at least through Giancarlo, we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, he's not the king of all financial markets, so he doesn't get, or the president, so he doesn't get to have too much say on this. But if
Giancarlo for president, I'm down. Well,
if he ran for Bitcoin president right now, he would win it.
I feel like a Giancarlo campaign funded by like those like Portopia dudes, like that's enough money to get someone going pretty fast.
I think that his war chest would be massive and highly illiquid. It would be
he'd be like the front runner, and then get hacked and then drop off.
Yeah, someone would send him like $2 million of UBIC, and he'd be like, "I really don't know what to do with this. What just got sent to me? Do I need a wallet for this?" I think that if that is a world that we enter next year or the year after that, where there are a lot of – where some of these scammy things are weeded out and there are legitimate companies who are competing across the world to try and make the best products, and that there is some sort of easier barrier to entry for normal people like you and me or any of the people who have, you know, have downloaded Coinbase to invest in these companies through –
token securities or something like that. I think that's like the world that we wanted when we got into this, right? And it seems like it might be more realistic right now, even though the price is down. Honestly, this is probably the most bullish you've ever heard me, Aaron.
I know. I feel like
it seems more realistic. I feel
like
your
happy place is like Bitcoin $5. Once we're there, you'll be like walking around with a Bitcoin T-shirt on.
We're gonna do this. I have so many Bitcoins right now. Let's do.
Jay
this.
Is only happy when it rains. Okay, so to tie up here a little bit. We've now, I hope, rock bottomed here. For your own bags, starting for me literally at square A, right back where I started. Are you going to do anything different this time?
Well, I mean, one thing that we talked about on Ledger's podcast, and you know, the reason why we talk to him so much is because we trust his general sense of the markets, and we find him to be an engaging and thoughtful thinker.
I like his his slow Southern accent. Also,
it does remind me of my childhood. He suggested that he didn't suggest. There is no financial advice here. Let's be clear.
Yeah.
But he did say that, you know, historically in the past, that alts have bounced back harder than Bitcoin during these periods. And so I would think that maybe once I am certain that the market is going to turn back to bullish, that I should redistribute into alts. The other thing, though, that I think that he has been saying on his Telegram channel, or that I've also noticed, is that there just is not that much volume on places like Bittrex. And so I'm a little bit worried about it, honestly. Like, I think that they probably will bounce back to a certain extent, but honestly, I don't think it's worth the headache. And this Binancing also scares me. Like, if I wanted to go out and buy 0x, which is a coin and a project that I really like, how would I even do that right now, you know? And how could I do that confidently, thinking that these exchanges are going to stay up? So I think I'm just going to stay mostly in Bitcoin.
Yeah, I'm going to reverse my general embrace of all things shitty when it comes to coins, and say this crash taught me, well, one thing it taught me is there's no way I'm gonna like slip out of alts just before the crash. I'm just like too sloppy, too slow, too likely to hold when I should sell there. So I think I'm going to go a little safer this time up. I'm mostly going with the projects. You know, I'm holding myself to my Blockfolio rule, which will be 7 coins, which means I need to shed 5 coins. So these are the coins I held all the way down. Bitcoin, Monero, Ubic, Ethereum, Sumo, Proof of Stake Wallet, POSOW, Power Ledger, Bancor, Sol,
no.
Qtum, Trust, and of course, my favorite delisted from Bittrex coin that I can't do move but still own, Darkris. So not counting Darkris, because I don't think it should take up a slot since I can't get rid of it if I want to. I got to shed like 5 of those, and that doesn't leave many slots. Like if you assume, like, you know, I'm a Monero fan, I think it makes sense to hold a little Bitcoin and Ethereum. That means I really only have 4 altcoin slots. So my goal is to like find stuff I really believe in. I think I'd like to get back into Aragon because I did really well on that. Everyone has always been like very people I know who are not into shit coins and are not into bullshit are very pro Aragon. So probably add that back in. And then it's just going to be some hard decisions about what I actually want to ride both directions, you know, because I think we're going to have more big crashes. Like, do you feel like we've rooted big crashes out of our system?
No, they happen like clockwork, and it just depends on the severity of it. You know, there are easy crashes like the one we had before Christmas where, you know, you and I were BTFDing the whole way down, and then it snapped right back up, and we're like, whoa, if it's always like this, it's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
And then it crashed again, and it was nothing like that at all, and it was much worse, and if we had BTFD'd, we would be crushed right now. So,
I think I'm also going to stop trying to buy dips, because I was like, we talked about this a little on LedgerCast also. This time on the way up, I was buying dips, like when it dipped from like 17,000 to 15,000, I was buying. And yeah, I think those dips, like, I think that as it got really high, I thought like, oh, it's down $2,000 dip city. That's not a dip in Bitcoin. That's just like a normal day in Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's like someone took a shit.
Yeah, that's like someone mistranslated one word in a Korean document. That's dip. So I'm going to be only looking for these mega dips, I think, going forward.
Yeah.
Anything you've heard about, any projects that are exciting you, anything that, cause I know, Jay, I know you'll get a little self-righteous and say, I'm only doing the like legit stuff. And then, I usually hear a creeping like, urge to get involved in some, altcoin, shadery from you. Where are you at on that?
Yeah, I do not practice what I preach.
Well, you do for like a day, and then you start preaching. Well,
although this one, I will say, I've been pretty close to all Bitcoin and Ethereum and Monero for, you know, like almost 2 months now, which is very, 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 very rare. 2 months might actually be overselling it. Let's say 5 weeks. No, honestly, 0x is something that I do like, but you know, it was mostly traded on Binance, and Binance is gone, or is down. And if Binance snaps all the way back up, and you know, everybody on Binance feels great about it in a couple days, and doesn't, you know, volume doesn't drop precipitously, which I don't understand in any scenario, even if Binance is totally intact, structurally, I don't understand how people don't stop trading there. So I still believe in that project. I just have a hard time buying it right now because, you know, like this alt crash was brutal. And I guess I just kind of feel like, look, if Bitcoin takes off, then, you know, alts aren't going to do so well either. So, I'm going to wait until we see a little more stability.
I'm going to let you go because I know you got a shoot to get to there. I want to send out. I'm hoping that we can start giving some recommendations of stuff we're enjoying on this show. For people listening to the show, I enjoyed this week. It's on Netflix. There's an Alex Gibney series of documentaries called Dirty Money, but they're by different directors each one. I recommend the one, I think it's number 3, that Aaron Lee Carr directed about Valiant. Which is the company that later Martin Shkreli sort of mimicked their tactics and raised drug prices. It's a really fascinating story, and it's mostly about the short sellers who really exposed Valiant by sort of figuring out what was really going on there. I totally recommend it to our listeners. I recommend it to you, Jay. And it brought up in my mind the fact that these short sellers kind of actually almost perform a regulatory service on stocks where their investigations often expose corruption and bad actors in the system. But what this documentary showed me that I thought was interesting was that these people who are short sellers are almost like investigative journalists. They're really digging into the companies. And right now there's no one who is digging into a lot of these altcoins and seeing what's really going on. And there should be a financial incentive for exposing fraud.
Yeah. And you could have funny results like when Bill Ackman tried to short Herbalife and then Carl Icahn was like, nope.
And Bill Ackman's also in the Valiant story, but he's on the other side. Bill Ackman is like buying up Valiant and being like, it's not a fraud.
No one has gotten more publicly wrecked, by the way, than if you feel bad about your crypto getting wrecked and everyone making fun of you, just check out what's happened to Bill Ackman. Every time something gets wrecked, like Chipotle or something, like anything that gets totally wrecked, it's like, and Bill Ackman was heavily invested. Okay.
Cool. All right. Well, I'll see you when you're back in New York. Yeah.
All right. Cool. Good talking to you.
Later.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Thursday, February 8th at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $8,348.
Good show. Okay, that was Coin Talk. I'm Aaron Lammer. My co-host is Jay Kang. In addition to co-hosting this show, I also help produce and edit it. We are brought to you in partnership with Medium. You can find every episode at medium.com/cointalk, and that includes transcripts. Hey, do you have a question? Tweet it at us at Coin Talk Show or send it to us hi@cointalk.show. We're going to do a mailbag very soon. We've got some amazing mailbag questions waiting for us. I'm really excited about that. Also starting to get some interest from people who want to sponsor the show. Yes, the show costs money to make. Lots of people listen to it. There seems to be some sort of an alchemy that could support both there. So why don't you, if you are a company that is in the crypto space or even outside the crypto space, mattresses, underwear, we'll do anything. We'd love your support. Send us an email again, hi@cointalk.show, and we can send you some info and rates. Okay, see you next week.